and keep learning. And I think.
Well, I'm going to go.
Okay, my dear. I'm so happy to talk to you again, and that it's been too long. If you have any idea or any thought or anything you want to talk about or a brilliant flash, please feel free to call. Or is it giving birth to ourselves or giving birth to myself? I think it's giving birth to myself.
I think so too. Yeah, I like that, and I think there has to be let me see, what's the word? The realization of just giving birth to oneself, the realization of values, the realization of a change, the realization of more than just what we were talking about, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. So maybe say that again if you don't mind.
Giving birth to myself is true because what we spoke about, This new paradigm, I mean, giving birth to oneself gives rise to the fact that one has come to a realization of something. It's more than giving birth. It's giving birth to the world in some ways. So myself becomes more than myself and has to be in order to make change.
Yeah, it's kind of like giving birth to the future.
Yes. It has to be seen as much, much more. Yes, giving birth to myself, a Harlem's midwife story. That it arouses the implication that giving birth to myself is more than just myself. It's realizing truths that are necessary. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean, what does giving birth to myself mean? That's what needs to be explored. Well, what does that mean, giving birth to myself? Is that a little interpretation? How will I apply giving birth to myself to what needs to be done? Has it been an easy road? No. Has it been a fair road? Is it a road for women and mothers and babies and fathers and families? No. What will make it change or begin to make it change? How will giving birth to myself give rise to change? Or give rise, not give rise to change, have input, impact upon change. Because change is ever present.
Well said.
Yes.
Good, good, good. I look forward to our continued exploration of giving birth to ourselves.
Yes, yes.
You are mentioning how the birthing system has become a delivery system.
Yes, yes. I like that too. The birth. I'm writing things down too as we're talking. Birthing system has become. Yes, it has become. Yes, it has. So that no longer, women are not no longer giving birth. They're being delivered of a product. So as we're speaking around the country, the goal is to get the baby out, to get this product out. There's no need to have childbirth classes anymore. We can give you Pitocin, and we can artificially get that uterus contracting and get the baby out. If the pain is too severe, and it will be too severe with Pitocin, we give you the epidural. So right now, anesthesiology, they're making so much money. I mean, because they're making money hand over fist. It's to the point now that you, at 38 weeks of gestation, your pregnancy, that's the cutoff point now. That means that's the magic number, 38 weeks. They don't want you to go much further than 38 to 39 weeks. And women, they come in, they put in those monitors, they lay in that bed as if they are not, as if they become sick. They're made to feel psychologically sick. They put them in those beds. They're not able to drink anything. They have the IV. they're strapped up to the monitor, and the process begins. And even prior to that, with all those sonograms that are being given to these women, not just one, they must be given a sonogram every trimester. So now people know that's why it's becoming so technological, because parents know what they're having. They just know, and they know this from their TV. They have these TLC programs that give them the illusion that what they're seeing is what's gonna happen, and that's not true at all. So they're sort of like lulled into an expected role even before they get to the hospital. They're not being empowered. They're not informed properly. So they win. So as we speak right now, women across the country are being manipulated. They're being coerced. They're being sort of forced into a type of procedures that are not beneficial to them. And once they protest, they're told, if you're my sister or if it was my wife, I would do X, Y, and Z. So, you know, the woman feels a little guilty. You know, maybe I better do it against my better judgment. I'm not saying, sir, that C-sections and augmentation of labor and induction is sometimes not necessary. But when it's done to the degree that it's maximized at this point, this is bordering on it borders on criminal. This is almost criminal. And we're talking about domestic violence, but these women are being violent. They're being abused, and they're giving the largest operation right now is the episiotomy, and secondly is that C-section. As I said before, some of the rates are rising, 40, 50. Brazil, 80 to 90% of women having C-sections. So burping is almost a thing of the past. It's becoming a thing of the past. Delivery, you might say, is more the term, not burping. And so because of this new paradigm, there's a major disconnect that not only begins at birth, because see, birth is such a defining moment. It's an imprint. How a child is born, how that mother, the father, how that birthing takes place. It's a binding imprint of how one perceives themselves. It's critically important how a child is brought into this world. Critically.
Sorry. And, well, you've been into, how many births have you been involved in yourself in Harlem?
Well, not only in Harlem. I've done births really basically internationally and nationally. 500 births. I think I've seen enough. I've been a midwife since 81. I've seen enough births to make me see that this birthing is important, and midwives have always been since the beginning of time. With ACOG, the American Obstetrical and Gynecological Professional Organization. They're making a statement, a professional statement, an official statement last October at their convention, that hospital births are the only safe births, that births outside the hospital are unsafe. That also has an effect on how women are being birthed. How babies are being born. I cannot stress to you how, as we're speaking at this very moment, around this country, in every in crevices that you would not think of, major hospitals, they are abusing these women. They're manipulating them. They do it in such a I don't want to use the word artistry, but it's such a way how they twist the things around, and how women, they're not having their backs rubbed in labor. No. They're not being asked, well, miss, maybe you can help you, and you can utilize maybe the gravitational energy to assist you and maybe dilating more. How can you dilate if you're laying in bed? How can you do it? Maybe if the bed was vertical, that would help a lot. Maybe there should be a need to make vertical birthing beds delivery beds, as opposed to the horizontal bed. Then the woman could utilize her muscles. Why does she have the pregnancy when you see how the woman's body changes and how her thighs get stronger? Those muscles, that's an intention for assistance during birthing. No, that's the thing of the past. They're laying right now in those hospital beds waiting to give. And you don't hear any noise anymore. That's the other thing. You don't hear the cries anymore. You go into those floors and it's quiet. You hear the fetal monitor. You hear that, but you don't hear women anymore. You know, the way you used to hear women. No, you don't hear that. You can look at this nurse's station and you see all these video screens that are hooked up to each monitor per room. Some of the hospitals have beautiful, beautiful, so-called, they call them birthing suites. They're just delivery assembly lines, but just more elaborately, aesthetically done to give you the illusion that you have input in how you have birthing. You can, but you gotta be informed, and you gotta be strong, and you gotta know exactly what you're talking about in order for you to get the kind of birthing that you want to have. It's exhausting. By the time you explain yourself to them over and over again, I want to do this, and I don't want it that way, I want to breastfeed, I want to stand up, I want to sit down, I want to squat, whew, you're exhausting. So birthing entails the sense of empowerment, so that women can say that I did it. I mean, after that labor, at points when you say that I can't do it, I can't go any further, and you have someone to encourage you, you can do it. And when you have given birth, it's such an exhilarating, the empowerment, because then you can say, I can do anything, because I had a baby. Now, you hear women say, how many stitches did you get? Oh, you had a boy? Oh, okay, yeah. Then the next question, down that road, they're going to ask, well, I forgot the word they use now, did they induce you? Oh, yes, they know the word induction. They know the word induction. So they say, did they induce your labor? You had a C-section? I did too. Yes. And now it's more and more said to women, once a C-section, always a C-section. Those VBACs are out. Because ACOG, again, a few years before this, came out with their official statement that they considered VBACs to be unsafe.
What is a VBAC?
A VBAC is a vaginal birth after delivery. At one time, and it depends on the incision. If the incision is horizontal, the chances for they're afraid of the uterus rupturing, that's what they say, the uterus is going to rupture, and so that's why they consider the VBAC not to be safe anymore. So generalized procedures are individualized this become individualized for everybody. Everybody has to have the same thing. So there's an increase in vacuum-assisted births, on forceps births, and all kinds of intervention, all kinds of painful. I mean, it must be quite painful for that baby, tugging and pulling and thing. So we got to make a change. There's a need for a change. We're going to have to make a change. By the time that woman has that baby, that disconnect is there, the imprinting that I talked about before, which is so very important, it becomes another way.
What imprinting? Can you kind of?
Well, I guess it's like the imprint of birth. That down to the imprint of birth. It's a moment that you. It's an initiation, I guess. It's a way of how a person is born. And there have been studies that say that the way you're birthed is the way that you perceive yourself, your sense of well-being, your sense of relationships in the future. All this goes back to how people are born. It's not just you babies that come into the world. No, it's something much more to than that.
And that much more is. Can you clarify a little more on that? Just because I think it's so important to think about what that really means to the mother and the baby and their relationship.
That's true. That's very, very true. Clarification might be, let's use breastfeeding. Let's say a mother, I'll give you two examples. A mother who has gone through the process of having her induction, getting that artificial Pitocin to open the uterus, dilate the cervix, and so that she can give birth. She is next then given an epidural and the anesthesia or the pain medication, the analgesic rather, to deaden the effects of that powerful Pitocin. By the time she has that baby, she is not motivated as a woman who did not have the Pitocin, did not have the induction. She had the natural Pitocin, which has that bonding element to it that makes that woman seek out that baby that's interested in that contact, and that breastfeeding mode, it goes into play. The other way around, where the separation, now I feel no pain, I'm just laying there, I'm awaiting delivery of a product. It's a big difference between the two, you know, the two mindsets. It's a very big difference. Awaiting a product and being a passive participant as opposed to being actively involved. So the activeness, the movement, the way she has to give birth, the way she utilizes her body is very, very different than the way the other woman who's in that bed with that IV, the monitor is constantly going, you can't move. It's a big difference. So their bodies, their mindset is not motivated to giving, to breastfeeding, to making them see the importance of breastfeeding.
There's a disconnect. There's a disconnect, it seems, you know, from...
Not only does it affect the birthing, the early, that first year of life, this goes on, and the child's affected by this sense of disconnectedness in their preschool years. So they're cognitively and emotionally, there's something that's quite not, you can't put your finger on it, but it's just not the same. Maybe there are studies of observing children who have been breastfed and children who are not breastfed. There's a big difference, health-wise.
Well, maybe, as you say, the passage through the birthing of life, of giving birth to yourself in some ways as the process of birthing, is far-reaching implications, unintended consequences, where a child maybe goes through life feeling disconnected, and we don't really realize that.
I don't really know, because some things, you know, become a part of our subconscious, so we're not able to pull back. Why can I relate to so-and-so the way I would like to? I don't have a sense of trust to the other person. Why is that? Because that birthing opens the road up to a sense of that trusting that the child must develop in that first year of life, that I must trust that person to feed me, to care for me, to love me. All that is a part of it. I'm not saying that the mothers and the parents, the mothers and the poor fathers don't love their children in the same way that another, that they breastfed, or the woman, the parents who had an active birth, active participation. I'm not saying that in their birthing, but it just that it could have been made a little bit, what's the best way? It could have been made, like you're making a cake or something, and the cake tastes good, but it could have tasted better. It could have been a little bit better. You see, the consequence could have been, the outcome, it could have been better for everybody involved. It's not better for everybody involved, this new paradigm of women being delivered as opposed to giving birth.
Well, let's think about that for a second. What is the positive sides of delivery? Who benefits from the concept, that you're looking at the birthing process as a positive thing? But let's put ourselves on the other side and see, how did we get to this point? Who benefits from this?
Who benefits from it? Okay, well, I would say that the doctors benefit, the insurance company benefits, it's time management, it's money. They benefit. I don't see where women benefit. What benefit is it for them? Except for them to know, the benefit for them, they're not going to have any pain. And I guess the way we think now, not having pain, even if it's good pain, who wants to have pain, though, in a way? When you think about it, if I have a toothache, I don't want to feel the pain. I will take the medication. And if my leg or my back or part of my body hurts, I don't really want pain. No. So psychologically, if I'm given the choice of saying, do you want pain or do you not want pain as you have your labor? Well, women are gonna say, I don't want the pain. It is painful giving birth, but there are measures that one can utilize and strategies that will make that process to be less painful, but not inflict a consequential kind of way. But that's a longer given a chance. So the natural interventions, like maybe massaging or getting into the bathtub or a nice shower or eating and having something to drink to give you that energy to surge like the marathon runners have. I noticed along the way that they're given as a full carbohydrate diet to begin with, and as they run and run and run, that they get something to keep them moving along. But when you give birth, when you deliver, and having labor in this country, the IV becomes the receptacle, the vehicle. They say they give you nourishment. That IV doesn't give you any nourishment. It might prevent you from being dehydrated. But why can't the person drink a little bit? Why couldn't they have a little bit of honey or a little soup or something? Or whatever they wanted to have, a light, nourishing, energizing kind of foods that would give them that surge. To make them, not to make them, but to give them the energy, foundation so that one can give birth. Why isn't that? They always say that nothing by mouth. Cannot give her nothing by mouth. Give her some ice chips or something like that. You gotta actually beg to get it some juice in your mouth.
Why is that?
Because they're thinking that this person might need to have a C-section. We might have to use anesthesia. This is the mindset always. What if part? So defensive medicine is played. But what is it played against? It's played against a so-called normal process. So it's like fitting a circle in a square. And the fit, it doesn't fit well.
How do we get to this place?
Money, business. And I'm pretty sure that a lot of those executives, or some of the executives that sit, let's say, in those formula companies, I bet you their wives breastfeed. Bet you that. I would bet a lot. Those wives are breastfeeding their children. It's money. It's big money. This country is run on that. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter in the short term what happens to the population at large. What matters is dividends. The money that we're going to make. So healthcare, what they call the healthcare industry, is a fragmented mismatch of, it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that a dying woman cannot, a terminally ill woman, or a man, cannot get care in a better way. There's just so many things that just don't make sense. So many people who are uninsured, they have to choose, well, can I buy that medication or do it? I won't buy A medication, I'll just buy B. I can't afford to get A, B, and C meds, I'll just buy one. Well, I don't buy none at all. I just have to do the best I can. It's just not fair, it seems. You work all your life, and you come to a point where you want you should be just have a better quality of dying, if dying in a more dignified way. You're not even giving that because the insurance is not going to pay for that. Everything is out of network. Midwives are out of network, so they have to go to that facility. No, I'm sorry. That's just how it is. Speak to the insurance company, and it just becomes who will control by the pharmaceuticals. So it's everybody's involved in this. They're sweetheart contracts. The WIC program, that federally funded program that's been in existence for over almost 30 years now. How much good has that done to the population?
What is the WIC program?
The WIC program is a women and infant children's program that's federally funded by the by this country, and is contracted out to formula companies who provide the so-called formulas to babies. Basically, it's a formula program. There are other offshoots from it, but if you look at the formula. Most of them have about 27 ingredients, and I dare say milk is one of them. They're all kind of oils and chemicals that you can't even pronounce, and the children tend to grow larger for the age. If you feel their skin, if you touch the skin of a child who's breastfed and a skin of a child who's bottle-fed, the bottle-fed baby's skin feels very taut, has a tightness to it, whereas you can sort of feel there's a difference in the texture of the skin. The babies get larger. We're led to think that a big baby is a healthy baby. When a lot of times if not, so that, I mean, there's also some kind of a relationship that's being proposed now between these respiratory illnesses like asthma and this formulas that are given. So it's a whole lot of things that are affected about how women giving birth. And when I say women, I mean the parents. I mean women and men, but I'm just using women as the generic term to avoid saying women and men, fathers and mothers. I'm just using mothers in the broad sense of the word.
Now you had mentioned earlier, and maybe you could talk a little bit about that, maybe obesity issue comes into play with these WICs. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yes. I mean, you can just see the 10, 15 years difference, how big these children are, how they're not just big, they're fat. These children with these bellies, that they're weak muscles. And yet, they're big children. I'm beginning to think, not only I'm not saying, it's not personal. So you begin to wonder, what are these children eating in infancy? And how are they being fed? What is it? There's a lot of discussion now, a lot of concern about these formulas and the relationship of formulas to how they're growing and what they're eating, the formulas and the fast food, and then it just goes on. These convenient foods that begin with that formula. So all the woman has to do now is to twist that nipple on the bottle, or she puts the powder in the bottle, add a little water, shake it up, and give it to the baby. That's all she has to do now. She doesn't have to go through that process. And she don't want to feel my breasts. The initial, sometimes, it can be uncomfortable initially getting in the nipples toughen up to accommodate the baby. But with WIC there, she knows that she's being told that she can both bottle feed and breastfeed. And then when you give the baby the bottle, the baby doesn't have to suck as hard because the milk just comes out very freely out of the nipple. Not milk, that formula rather. It comes very freely out of the nipple, and so it's much easier for the baby to suck. And the mother, she interprets that my baby doesn't want my breast. She wants your breast. Beautiful breast, beautiful nipples. Oh, the nipples are so beautiful to breastfeed. My baby doesn't want to breastfeed. No, he doesn't like it. So I'm giving him the formula. I'll do it later. By the time they get home after that C-section, you think they might want to breastfeed? After having that induction, now they have the post, sometimes women have the post-epidural effects now. Back, they have trouble headaches. Back discomfort. It doesn't flow. It doesn't, A plus B does not equal C, you know?
And what about the postpartum blues?
It's probably accelerated. It's probably because it's more stressful. So I'm sure that it's an accelerated process. Those women have to get up. They have to leave their homes within that first week after that baby's born to make their appointments for the WIC, so that they can get those vouchers, so that they're able to get the formula. So they make sure that they get up and out, go and get it. It's free. It's no cost to them, and so that's what they do. And they can use that formula for as long as is necessary for that baby to have. I tell the mothers, if it's that good, then maybe you should drink the formula, you know?
You've gone through this process yourself. How many kids do you have?
I have 7 children. Now, what? I had 3 babies born in the hospital, and then I had the other children after I began to see things very differently. The last 4 children, they were born at home.
And what was that like for you? Personally,
Personally, at the sense of being at home, the sense of being in a familiar surroundings, the support system being there, I had competent midwives. I did have a backup physician, or the midwife had backup physician rather. But being in your own setting helps a lot, as opposed to going to a place where you don't know, it's not a familiar setting. So those, even though that might be a small, it might be insignificant, it's not insignificant because the sense of anxiety is there. You have to reorient yourself to a surrounding when you also should be focusing on how you're going to, on the labor process itself, you know. It brings the family closer together, I noticed. There are a lot of, but the person who does, the woman who decides, the parent who decides on home birth, have to have a certain mindset to begin with. They have to be willing to want to do that. It has to come from them. And I'm not saying that all babies who are home, who have babies, in my case, it was good for me. I'm not saying that babies, mothers, parents who have their babies at home are a special breed. It's just a different mindset. It's being more informed. And everybody may not want to have a baby at home, and that's perfectly fine. If you want to have a baby in a hospital, then let's have a baby in a setting that's more conducive to women giving birth and not being delivered. Let's play a little bit more of Even Steven, you know?
Your relationship to your home birth kids as in relationship to your hospital birth kids, how is that different?
I'm not saying that it's different. There were differences for me coming home after the babies were born as opposed to being right there in my home. That's where the differences were. That support system that's there, I would say that was a difference. In terms of me relating to my children, that's the reason why I decided to have a baby at home, because I realized that at the hospital it wasn't working. It was the environment itself. I found it to be sort of cold and uncaring. More cold, and I couldn't do what I thought that I wanted to do. I couldn't get out of bed. I couldn't get that fetal monitor off me for 20 all the time. I just couldn't do actions that I thought would be helpful. I couldn't get someone. You only have two people there at the hospital. I might have wanted four, five, six people in my room. You get to decide, should it be my husband and the grandmother, or should it be the grandfather? And you know, the decisions that should not have been are put into place in the hospital setting.
So, as your first time you were pregnant, what do you recall? What your thoughts were about that? You know, what you went in, what it would be like.
I was very naive. I was a young mother. I was 19. What did I think? 39 for the pound. Excuse me 1 minute. 39
for the pound.
That's
fair. Fair weight. Fine.
Okay, and then I'll go see about it. Okay, keep the chopping hot with you in case we are lucky.
Where are you calling? Where are we calling from?
We're calling from Harlem.
Harlem. And you're at your home, you're at your work, you're at a...
No, I'm at home. I'm at home.
Oh, okay.
I'm at home today. So, so for me to say that, I'm trying to go back to my train of thought. I felt more empowered at home. I felt that I could, the sense of being able to do it in my own bed or wherever you want to have the baby at. It's a sense of saying, you're just more familiar. I also noticed, too, though, as a midwife, that for some reason there's less bleeding, there's less blood at home than it is in the hospital. I even noticed that the umbilical cord comes off sooner in the main. I'm not just in the main than it does of a baby who's born in the hospital. There are some differences. And also the imprinting, you know, you're in a warm, think about the uterus. Yes, it's warm. It has to be warm. It's closed. It's a comforting sort of space. And then all of a sudden you're exposed to, and it's dark. So the light is very important. That the light, the glaring light, the sounds, the coolness. Immediately, you're taken, not immediately, but very shortly after you're born, you have to have a bath. Why must you have a bath? Why must a baby who's been in a sterile environment, that's a sterile environment, why must they have a bath so soon after being born? Why must they have that, some sort of a, well, I guess they have to have these injections right away, but it's sort of shocking to the psyche. It's shocking to the body for this to suddenly take place. And even more so if it's a C-section. C-section, some of them are very necessary. But I'm talking about the ones that are not necessary. It must be a shock to cure in one spot, and then you're suddenly yanked up out of something, it's disorienting. It's a disorienting kind of experience. So that's what it is. So you're disoriented. That sense of self and well-being, to see a baby being born naturally, I hate to use that word naturally too, but I'm going to use the word, and to see the baby who's born with, who's in the labor being induced, the contractions are hard on that baby, on the baby itself, the sounds, that constant monitor. I want monitor going on all the time. Sometimes, in order for the baby to be monitored more properly, an internal monitor, that little screw, is literally screwed into the baby's head, and then it's attached to the to the monitor. The electrode, rather, is attached to the baby's head, leaving scars. Many times it leaves a scar that never goes away on the baby's head. But just imagine how it is from an infant's, a newborn's perspective. Someone who has no conscious recollection of even been here before. If that's the case, if we have been here before, we have no conscious recollection of being here before. Wow, why must it be such the transition to come into this world be so violent? It becomes an act of violence, and that knifing of the woman's peritoneal, the so-called get the baby's head out to birth the baby sooner. Sometimes it's necessary to do an episiotomy, but I can tell you that 95% of those episiotomies are unnecessary. But they'll say, you know, it's better, she'll have a return back. Some say it's better for sex, and some others say that whatever they say, it becomes known that the providers who are doing that delivery don't know how to manipulate or to manage the baby's head in a way that the woman is not torn, so that episiotomy largely becomes unnecessary. But now that's a part of the ritual. First time mothers, second time mothers, you just get that episiotomy any old way. It doesn't matter. That's what I'm saying. What's good for all is good for one. That's it. Line up. You saw this. Did you ever see this documentary? Well, it was not a documentary. It was a film that was done by, I think his name is Charles Barnett, The Killing of a Sheep. I think that's what it was called. Yeah, it was called The Sheep, Killing of the Sheep. And he shows, as a part of his document, of his film, rather, he's using the way the sheep are killed. He's comparing that to a life, a situation. So they passively move along each part of the way to their death. And that's what's happened to us, to women. We're passively moving along to the unknown, known by only those, and that known is not conducive. It's not the one's well-being. Hello?
Yeah. No, I'm just speechless.
And it's called Killing of the Sheep.
But what, how you interpret that is pretty profound in terms of bringing it back to where we are in the birthing process.
Yes, where are we at in the birthing process?
You know, we're like sheep.
Yes, we're like sheep, passively moving along. And in this film that he does, he just shows the different stages in terms of where the sheep is at each point of it, of their incoming death. It shows you the workers and what's happening, a little bit of what's happening. You just go from one, and then he takes it back to the lifetime that he's trying to also the life circumstances rather that he's developing as well. And so you're constantly going back and forth between the killing of the sheep and what's happening in this community that he's filming. Yeah.
How did we get to this spot?
Oh, power and money. I guess that's what it boils down to, money and power.
What does that say about us?
There's very little respect for life, for the process of life. This God-like mentality. I don't know. I think that it's going to have that word that you use, unintended consequences. It's definitely going to kick in.
I mean, you know, it all starts in the birth, and in the process of birth.
It all starts there.
And if we're born coming from this place of where we all have been in, which is just this warm ocean of just that has no words.
Has some words. That's right. It's true. Why must it end up like this? Why must that infant have to experience something like this? If that's the way it was, then why is it now? Why do And that infant also, not only the infant, the newborn, the unborn child, they say that the child knows their parents' voices. And I guess you would have to know, if you're living within something for a while, you would have to know that, how the person's voice, how they feel, the energy, the design, if they're scared. All that affects... It has to have an effect on the way you birth, the way you perceive yourself, the unintended fear.
And what about all these people who, you know, just go along with their lifestyle when they're pregnant?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, go along abusing themselves and not thinking about the consequences and, you know, and just drinking and eating and drugging.
Yeah.
And without any realization that maybe that the society that they're bringing their child into, or that they're, you know, that they were born into. I don't understand that, how it is that some pregnant women just are oblivious. I've seen.
Well, it's not too hard when you think about, we are oblivious anyway. We are oblivious to our surroundings anyway, because we are lulled into other, we're distracted. so we're distracted by so many things in our lives, the TV being one of them, or the DVD, or whatever the current distracting item is, we're distracted. So we don't, and then we have a complete trust, it seems. We are very trusting of our providers, because we believe, and we should believe, that they're going to do the best thing by us. And then we don't know. We have the baby, and we believe, they say that we got to have this induction. And everybody now is on to this expectancy date. So if you're told your baby is born on June 5th, that's the day. No one is told that it could be 2 weeks before, 2 weeks after. I really hear women say that my baby is due June 5th, but it might come before, it might come after. They're just told on June 5th, that's when the baby is going to be here. And that dictates everything. Those sonograms, everything is dictated by date and time, and money, of course. The baby's not here by June. Well, now it's before, because they don't really wait until June 5th now. Your due date is not that. They have other plans. There's other plans involved for you. We're not going to wait for June 5th. That baby's coming out before that time. This is business, and it's true. Some women might be in labor for labor divided into different stages, but maybe that prodromal labor, that first stage of labor, which could take a long, long time. They're not willing to wait for no long time labor. No, baby have to come now. Come sooner than that. We have other things to do. We have this money to make. Well, generally, first-time mothers' labors are longer, and that's why midwives, people who are trained to manage labor, as long as no signs of women of any complications during that first stage of labor, and you begin to do things to help her have a shorter stage, or to be able to endure that first stage, and as long as dilatation is taking place in a way that's progressive, if she's not stuck in a certain point, then she might need to have augmentation taking place. But then the woman should be allowed to labor. She should be allowed to labor, all things being equal. And everybody's labor, every labor is different. From one birth to the next, each labor is different. So it's sort of hard to generalize, and that's where the problem is at. Again, it's hard to fit each person in the same shoe, and that's what's being done now, to put them all in the same shoe. Your labor, she's a first-time, second-time mother, so she should regress, let's say, 1.5. They even have it out. 1.5 centimeters per hour, that's the way it should be done. Friedman's curve must be followed, or else. If it's not followed, then let's go to the next thing. And so when you're dealing with a natural process and you start intervening, then the consequences become known. You're going to have complications here. The heart rate is going to drop, and we're going to have to do an emergency C-section or whatever it might be. But when you start, messing in things or trying to manipulate nature, then nature goes airy. You're fixing something that was right. Now you got to fix it because you made it go wrong, and to get it, it doesn't go back on course like that. So you can't undo what you've done. You got to do it now. You got to do it in another kind of way, and that's in the way of a mechanical model. See, that's no longer healthy for neither mother nor baby. It's really individualistic. It really is. That's why every mother has a different story. They all have, my baby was born in 2 hours, and his was born in 8 hours, and I had her at So everyone has a different story, so it doesn't become boring because each labor is so different. Yeah, I thought I was going to have that baby at 2 o'clock, and it came at 4, and sometimes the baby may not come until the father gets there, or there are all kinds of factors involved. Well, the woman doesn't knowledge because she might have had a sexual experience that was not conducive. She might have been abused sexually when she was a child, and there's so many factors that come into play. I so much respect the process of birth. I tend not to respect the process of delivery because I see that it's cruel. It's cruel. It's a punishable. It's punishing a woman and a family. And it's being done in a very deceptive kind of way. So at the end of this ordeal, the woman says thank you when she should have been, I don't know what she should have been doing, but not to say thank you to service that was unnecessary. That was not necessary. More motivated by the organization.
Rather than the people they're treating.
Exactly. That's the sad part. It's not only sad, it's just, we're not going to live to see the consequences. You know, what you're saying, that I like that unintended consequences, because we're not going to live to see the consequences. And they are going to be, they're going to be of large magnitude, these things that are taking place now. But history will tell the truth, because that's what happens. Some part of history always tells the truth. It can be manipulated, but some historian is going to tell the real truth of this matter.
Are you worried about the future?
I'm very, very pessimistic about the future on so many different levels. I'm the family structure is breaking up. There's so many things that's taking place, and again, we go back to birthing. Women have their parents, or they're working all the time. They barely have time to be with those children. That's another thing too about this birthing, this so-called delivery system. In some countries, women are given to, if you're working, you get maybe 50% of your pay for 1 year. In Cuba, those women are given a maternity leave for 1 full year. I think it's 60% of their salary. So that gives them time to spend time to nourish and to be with their babies. This country doesn't want that. Back to work.
How does it work in the United States?
I think it's for 3 months. That's it. Some have six, some are 6 weeks. Yeah, 12, it's 12 weeks. 12 times 4 is 3. So 6 to 12 weeks is what you're giving for your so-called maternity leave. You're back to work. Or you don't have a job. But now, I got to be mindful of the time. I got to go up to the hospital to deal with insurance up there for someone that I love. Who is dying? But I have to go up here now. I gotta go up here now and see and argue why. And I want to even publicize this too. If I don't get what that woman has worked for her life, she's been working. She just stopped working 2 months ago, but she her illness now has become terminal, and the insurance company or so-called they're refusing her particular out-of-network hospitals. I gotta go up here now and meet with the so-called social worker to see what her plan is and how are we gonna have our plan as a family, how are we gonna work with, how she's gonna work with us rather. So I have a 2 o'clock appointment to go up to the hospital. I wasn't prepared to talk with you.
No, but this is great. I really I'm glad that we've had this moment in time, because I think it's a seed that maybe your concerns and my concerns, that we have a more humane and creative rather than an insane and inhumane society.
Yes, yes, and there are people out there who are of like minds. We just have to increase it. We have to increase the numbers, and we have to increase the antes. And it's much more than just marching, because we could have done that this year, and we were going to march in August. But then I stopped thinking that if we march, you have to have a strategy. You just can't go out there and march, you know. You have to be, we got to plan this activity in a way that's going to benefit us as women.
Well, I think one of the things in talking with you is really, you know, people in education think that it's, you know, the first few years, and by the time the kids are in high school, they can't really touch them. I have another friend who actually talks to kids, and he says, "I'm not really talking to you. I'm talking to your unborn children." Because he knows that they're already damaged in some way. But maybe in our own little way, this conversation can start people thinking that it really starts even before you're pregnant.
It does.
And that you have to be a good, fertile ground. You are, you know, women are the earth. And they need to take back that responsibility.
Exactly.
For the future.
That's right. We got, so that's a good way of putting it. Of seeing even a strategy of going out there and saying, look, Harlem Hospital, whatever the place might be, or so. We're taking back our responsibility as women. We want a more supportive. We don't want this kind of assembly line. Killing the sheep kind of affair. We want a different. We want midwives. Columbia has been contracted to provide midwives and doctors and whatever it is at Harlem Hospital. Columbia has lots of money. They're the second largest or the third largest landlord in the city of New York. They have the money. And as they're taking over the property in this community here, they can also find the money to increase the number of midwives at that particular hospital setting.
That would be one aspect of our conversation. But I see it that for people who might listen to this or watch what we're doing or pay attention, I see it more as a universal concept. Construction in terms of maybe we need to take back the future.
Oh, I agree with you. I'm just using that as an example. I totally agree with you. There will be a future because it's on so many different levels.
And then maybe it starts with childbirth.
The prison system, the number of people in prison. If there's so many, the implications are endless.
Where we live in a society that is driven by fear, and where most of it is the fear of not belonging, and we're easily herded because we want to believe.
That's right.
And my theory is that we're all pretending that we're zombies, so we go along to get along, but we really know better. We know that there's something missing. We know that there doesn't have to be this way. But we're afraid.
Yes. We are afraid.
We're afraid to not belong. So we go along to get along. And maybe if we're going to change things, we have to. It's not about organizations. It's the power of one person, each one of us, to make a difference.
That sounds wonderful. Let me see now. Where are we at here? I hope you can help our organization, because really this is coming from an organization, of a nonprofit grassroots organization, and who are made up of women who are trying to, who are going to make a change. And we're going to implement this strategy and other things we're going to be doing too. to educate our community about birthing, about not being delivered, birthing, having a baby, and trying to synthesize this into a way that they can understand the importance of it. But you know what? And once again, it has to come on the children's level, because you have to get them. I think that if you were, like we did a moon time, I've been doing a moon time program with young girls, preparing them for menstruation, but using that as a way to make them more involved in their own self-care. And I see that if this could be done for little children, they'll be more motivated to eating well, preparing their bodies for birthing, being more motivated. They can do a lot. There are a lot of things that one could do at different time frames, getting the 9 to 10, 11-year-old, talking to them, it's not the same as talking to the 13 and 15-year-old and so forth, but it becomes a building block. So like you're building from on each level, and when they become of age, they're able to fall back onto what they've learned in a way that would make their sense of who they are. They'll become lifelong health consumers as well as lifelong informed consumers. Because we just lulled into things that we're not aware of.
Well, that sounds really very empowering for young people. You know, I have 3 wonderful hours of you that we talked about, if I recall correctly.
Yes, yes.
And I really love that. And
I would love to have that.
Yeah, well, we've got more. And I'm recording this as we talk, as you know.
Oh, dear, yes, indeed, yes, indeed. I hope you're not going to have me go to the jailhouse, though.
Well, I don't think so. But if you go, I'll have to go with you.
It's true.
So you'll have company.
Yeah. It's true. It might be coming down to that, though.
Well, you know, I always figure you have to be careful, because there's a point where you're actually empowering the people you're trying to change, because you're giving, you know, it's kind of like if you notice, all of these governments are cracking down on so-called dissidents, people who don't agree with them.
Yeah.
Well, and they are actually making the government stronger. You know what I mean? These despots stronger, because they don't, they think they're activists and they're fighting for truth, but they're actually giving them, empowering them by giving, you know, creating an opposition. So there's a trade-off there that a lot of people don't realize when you become when you go through change, that you're actually sometimes creating, heightening the tension, and you know, it's just like happened in Burma recently, or it's just happened in Pakistan with Musharraf, and it happens all over the world, because governments aren't really concerned with the people, that are only concerned in staying in power.
That's right.
So our thing, and my thing is to listen and to pay attention, because there's always something to learn, and to make a difference. And there's a wonderful woman who I've been wanting to film, who won a Nobel Prize for her name is Wangari Maathai.
Oh yes, yes, yes.
From Nairobi or Kenya? Well, I can't remember.
Yes.
And she planted one tree because she saw that around the world, around her, the people were burning up the trees for their fire, for their camp, you know, to cooking. And there were going to be no more trees. So she said, well, we got to start planting trees. So she planted one tree, then she planted another. And then after a number of years, there were 30 million trees that were planted,
Oh,
and
30 million?
they un she they unplanted the government. But as is always usually the case, today's revolutionaries are tomorrow's tyrants. She just dropped out of the new government that she that had her in it because it was corrupt. How do you deal with these things when you're constantly confronted with organizations that tend to be about top-down management by fear? And that's the thing that I think we have to pay attention to in the long run. Not to replace things, but to change our way of thinking so that we learn something different rather than keep on repeating the same history, the same mistakes, the same wars, the same violence. And I think a lot of it starts with birth.
Phenomenal. It's not taken seriously as it should be. Because, at one time, first of all, birth is a very, very sacred event. It's not just, it's extremely sacred. The ancestors, your ancestors that you have are also present at birthing. I noticed that at birthing, the room it gets very hot. The energy shift and change. And there's a profound spiritualness to birthing that's taken out of the experience itself in the hospital setting. So that experience of where women and families should be able to realize that that's taken over, that's gone too, that's totally gone. But that being absent, that also affects the birthing process too, because it's absent in many ways. Without that factor involved, and those ancestors help. I've known many a time when I've done a birth that might have been a little more difficult and I needed some help. Maybe my hand was moved this way when I was moving the other way, and somehow or another it went this way. And I know that I didn't do that by myself. I know that I had some assistance from someone.
As you know, I delivered both my kids and delivered another kid 2 days after my daughter. Right. It was just the two of us. We had no help. And that's the way we wanted it. Is that it's a natural process. And we have to let nature take its course. And so, and not rush it. A lot of people's for example, see the crown of the head, and they think, oh, they got to be careful that something happens. But they're not breathing at that moment in time.
Begins to come into place.
So the whole thing is not to rush it. It's to let it come out so, as it decides.
Exactly.
So.
That's the paradox. Not, but the inclination is to rush, or the mother want to push real hard because it's burning. That's when you don't push.
I recall almost at times with at least my kids, my kids are older than me, but just putting my hand there so that it had some resistance,
Exactly.
in that it wouldn't, it wouldn't come out too fast. You allow the natural flow of things, the timelessness flow of things. And we don't give that time these days because everybody's busy. It's an assembly line.
We want to promote next.
Yeah, right. It's not what's there, it's what's next.
Exactly. Let's get those scissors out now. Cut that baby in. We're not gonna wait for that long crown and that birthing of the head to take place. Because it can be long. It can be a little
Oh
long.
yeah, that's why I was wondering. My ex-wife at the time thought is that minimally it should be 24 hours. Just assume that. From contractions to birth, but it could even be longer.
Yeah, see, it could be longer. It's true. Thank you.
But I figure that's why I was wondering also if you found that any kind of a time for the whole process And I think the slower it is, the better it is, in the sense of just giving. So it's a non-shock, and I also was very aware of when you were talking about light. I mean, first thing you want to do is protect the eyes, cover the eyes. I mean, baby's been
Yes,
in
exactly.
darkness, so for a whole week, you don't, you let them just come into the world gently, not shocking them. And I
Okay. Even a little, the other animals have their babies and their offspring in darkened areas. And so, because the eyes should be protected in a way. It should not be a shocking experience. Not the way it's too, that's the word, it's too shocking for the baby.
Yeah, it's imagine just you were once there. I mean, look, I was once there. One of the other things that I went with a doctor, wonderful doctor, in Stanford University, on his rounds one night at Stanford, at the Stanford Hospital pediatrics section, and we. And he showed me how to examine a newborn baby and how to adjust the hips because, sometimes you don't see that much anymore. But you used to see these people wearing elevated shoes on one side.
Oh, yes.
That's because the hips didn't fall in. Usually it does it in life, but those people it didn't happen and it could have been avoided. But he also told me you don't need to slap a baby like you see them in the hospital. He showed me you take your knuckles and you run up and down the spine, and that gets everything working. Had you heard that at all?
I could see that. I know that you don't need to shock the baby by slapping them or to arouse them. That's not necessary at all. In fact, that's also another criminal act of violence. There should be a administration. I thought they had the Administration for Children, but it's ACS. There should be one for babies. So for how they're being birthed, there should be a watchdog. To protect these babies against the manipulation and the cruelty that's it's benevolent cruelty that's taking place to these women as they're giving birth.
And it's part of it is not, the thing I think we should make clear is it not necessarily intentional.
It's not intentional. It's not intentional. It's why it's benevolent.
I mean, I'm sure everybody along the line believes in what they're doing.
Exactly so.
But the consequences and the unintended consequences are maybe some things that they're not aware of.
Exactly. And if they are aware of it, they say that it only happens once in a while. If they do even respect that much of it, you know?
And I also think a lot of it is driven by the almighty dollar, and that the insurance companies and the administrators, who they don't realize the consequences of this, that maybe. A lot of the prisons are full of people who were just never comforted, never felt.
That's right. A lot of the prisons are packed to the hilt with it.
And we're a violent society, and maybe,
Extremely violent.
yeah, it's incredibly violent. And a lot of it is we're addicted to fear, and we know the power of fear and the fear of power, and people use that because they know that they've been it's said that people who have been abused become abusers.
right.
And it's because they know the power of fear.
It's true, the oppressed become the oppressors.
Right. Because they've been there. They know what where you would think that maybe they would fight that. We live in a society that has kind of abandoned the future in many ways, and abandoned all hope.
Cannot see the future. Maybe it's something that they just can't see. They don't understand the future. They don't understand that destroying cultures have detrimental effects. I don't know what it is.
Well, you know, it's said that the flapping of a butterfly wings can not only change the course of a storm, but can create a storm. So this is the power of what one person can do to make a difference. And hopefully, people who listen to this, people who hear what in the future what we're doing, they may just make it may be thought provoking for them to be empowered to make a difference in their own community, their own lives, their own worlds, and their own families. You know, I'm all for encouraging people to take back their lives and take back the future.
Yes, because if not, there won't be a future. It's very simple. Either we do it, or the seeds have to be continually planted now, or there's not going to be a future. We want a railroad that has gone away, and we got to pull it back in. We got to put the brakes back on this railroad, this train rather.
The problem is that the trade of kings was in war, and we've been still trading in war and fear and violence and propaganda because our leaders don't understand better than we do about the power of fear.
That's right, that's right.
And we, the people, keep on changing the facts to fit our needs. And we really, and it's not about organizations. These organizations tend to become, the oppressor, the tyrants. Today's revolutionaries become tomorrow's tyrants. It is a very interesting perspective when you realize that we're in trouble. And that we really need to reinvent ourselves from this top-down management by fear. We need to rethink how come we've been repeating the same wars, the same violence since forever, since before forever. And we're still doing it today. And we wonder why we're at war and why we have a high population in the prisons. So, I know you have to go, but I was wondering, since this is, we're going to call our project here, Giving Birth to Ourselves, a Harlem midwife story, okay. Or a midwife Harlem story. What do you think?
A Harlem midwife story. That sounds good. I just got to think about it a little bit more. But so far, it sounds good to me.
So, just so I have that, could you say that?
Of course, we should be able to have this project. We say in Giving Birth to Ourselves, a Harlem midwife story.
Maybe you can say it a little closer to the telephone.
Giving Birth to Ourselves, a Harlem midwife story.
Great. Great, good. Because I that's how I want to use it. I want to use your language, your words, not mine.
Okay, you're gonna have me in the jailhouse.
Well, we'll for sure I'll be next to you. But that, I don't think we really, I think we're in trouble as a society, and that
Trouble, man.
and
That's why Margaret Mead, that was, she says, it starts with a small group of people. I forgot how she phrases what she says. It's so very important that we can change the world. And we gotta think like that. We gotta think of it on a macro management to macro management, that it can be done. That one tree that evolved from 1 to 30 billion trees. We have to think about that. If not, then why are we existing? What's the purpose of it all?
Yeah, well, I think that's the discovery, that we need to keep an open mind and explore the unimaginable and keep learning. And I think, okay, my dear, I'm so happy to talk to you again, and that it's been too long. If you have any idea or any thought or anything you want to talk about or a brilliant flash, please feel free to call. Or is it giving birth to ourselves or giving birth to myself? I think it's giving birth to myself.
I think so too. Yeah, I like that, and I think there has to be let me see, what's the word? The realization of just giving birth to oneself, the realization of values, the realization of a change, the realization of more than just what we were talking about, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. So maybe say that again if you don't mind.
Giving birth to myself. It's true because what we spoke about, this new paradigm, I mean, giving birth to oneself gives rise to the fact that one has come to a realization of something more than giving birth. It's giving birth to the world in some ways. So myself becomes more than myself and has to be in order to make change.
Yeah, it's kind of like giving birth to the future.
Yes. It has to be seen as much, much more. Yes, giving birth to myself, a Harlem's midwife story. That it arouses the implication that giving birth to myself is more than just myself. It's realizing truths that are necessary. Well, what does that mean? What does giving birth to myself mean? That's what needs to be explored. Well, what does that mean, giving birth to myself? Is that a little interpretation? How will I apply giving birth to myself to what needs to be done? Has it been an easy road? No. Has it been a fair road? Is it a role for women and mothers and babies and fathers and families? No. What will make a change or begin to make a change? How will giving birth to myself give rise to change? Or give rise, not give rise to change, have input, impact upon change. Because change is ever present.
Well said.
Yes.
Good, good, good. I look forward to our continued exploration of giving birth to ourselves.
Yes. Okay, so now we'll see you on Thursday. Now, let me see. I'm trying to see what I should do. What is your email?
Oh, it's GEO at givingbirthtomyself.com.